With our special guest, Robert Zubrin, talk a little bit more about the case for Mars and then his work in the energy field with Energy Victory. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, before we get into Energy Victory, let's talk a little bit more about the President George Bush program that never was.
Yeah, okay. So the Bush people knew that shuttle was going to go away around the end of the decade, and that the space program would have to find something else to do. Furthermore, it was clear the space shuttle itself was an inadequate and improper reason to have a space program. If you're going to, as the Gehman Commission that investigated the Columbia accident put it, if you're going to send people into space and accept those goals and risks, you need to have goals and risks that are worthy of risking human life. If you're going to accept the risks and costs, you need to have goals that are worthy of the risks and costs. Sorry, didn't put it well.
That's right.
They came up and said, okay, here's the idea. We'll fly the shuttle out till 2010 to finish off the space station, and then we'll close it down and we'll proceed, on to the moon and then to Mars. Moon by 2020 and Mars by 2030. Now, I thought this was a weak program precisely because while they would do a number of things while they were still around, essentially they were just leaving the thing hanging. I mean, I met with Mike Griffin, Bush's NASA administrator, in 2005, and I said to him, Mike, you have to have this thing most of the way towards getting to the moon by January 21st, 2009, or else the next president is going to drop it, because going back to the moon is not a very strong based program. It doesn't have a strong science rationale. It doesn't have strong public support. The only basis of supporting it is the fact that Bush and Cheney supports it.
Right.
And that's not going to cut any ice with the next administration. And so, in all likelihood, if this program is not well on its way by the time the next administration comes in, it's going to be canceled, which is precisely what happened. And what happened, though, that was even worse, that Mike could not have known in advance, was that this next administration would be very hostile to the idea of human spaceflight itself and might be interested in shutting the program down, and in any case would set in motion a tidal wave of budget deficits that would endanger a space program that was not very soundly based. You know, I mean, we've never had anything like this.
And most emerging countries, Robert, are trying to build their manned space program, and we're going the other way.
Yeah, no, it's a real problem. You know, what we really needed was for the Bush people to come out and say, first of all, the goal is humans to Mars, because that's the right goal.
Right.
And they needed to say in 2004, when they said it, humans to Mars by 2014, so that by...
Realistic goal.
Yeah, so that when 2009, when the next president came in, the thing would be, you know, well underway, and it would have strong public support, and it would have been very difficult to cancel.
Yes.
It did the opposite. But still, while they may have left the ship vulnerable, it was the Obama administration that fired the torpedo.
All right, so let's see where we stand now, and then let's talk about your Energy Victory, which has a lot of upside to it.
All right. Now, by the way, I just want to mention something. I'm the head of an organization called the Mars Society, and we're having our international conference in Dallas this week, beginning August 4th through August 7th at the Embassy Suites Hotel. And people can find out information about it at marssociety.org. And it's open to the public. You can come. We're going to have all kinds of speakers talking about the technology of sending humans to Mars, the politics, the science, all of it, every aspect of it.
Super.
There's an incredible agenda of speakers, and people listening to the show are invited to come.
Great. And let's hope you get a lot of mainstream coverage out there.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Energy, where do we stand? What's going on? Since you wrote the book, Energy Victory, what's happening?
Well, since I wrote the book Energy Victory, the United States economy was collapsed by the fact that we were dependent upon foreign oil.
Yep.
You know, in that book was published in the fall of 2007. In 2008, the price of oil proceeded to soar up to $140 a barrel. And in consequence, Americans paid $1 trillion for oil in 2008, compared to $90 billion in 1999, about $200 billion in 2003. So between 2003 and 2008, the amount Americans paid for oil went up by $800 billion. That's a third of what we pay the IRS. So we actually had a 33% tax increase under George Bush, except the money didn't go to Uncle Sam. It went to Uncle Saud and Uncle Hugo. And a tax increase like that is going to collapse economic activity, and it did. And 5 million people were thrown out of work. Now, there's a direct correlation between unemployment rates and rates of mortgage defaults, because unemployment people can't pay their mortgages.
That's right.
So people start defaulting on their mortgages. The mortgage-backed securities become worthless, and the banks start to fold, and all of a sudden you're in the world of $800 billion bank bailouts. That's what's happened between 2007 and today. Now, here we are. The price of oil, when the world economy crashed in 2009, the price of oil went all the way down to $40 a barrel, but now it's all the way back up to $100 again. And here we are. We're importing 5 billion barrels of oil. $100 a barrel, that's $500 billion we're paying for foreign oil.
And it even seems higher at the pump now, at this level, than it was at the higher level, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It's strange. I mean, it's well over $4 a gallon in most states. I can't figure it out.
It's about the same, but yes. But you see, the thing people really need to understand is that the oil price doesn't primarily hit you at the pump. It hits you by causing people to be unemployed. See, look at it this way. Let's say you owned a car that gets 30 miles to the gallon, and you drive 12,000 miles in a year. So that's 400 gallons of gas. If the price of oil goes from $2 a gallon to $4 a gallon, well, that's 2 times 400. It's costing you $800 in a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not so good. But it's a nuisance. But the fact that it's throwing people out of work is causing the value of your house to go from $400,000 to $300,000.
That's right. With no buyers, with nobody around to buy it.
Right. So you lose $800 at the pump and $100,000 in equity off your house. This is how the oil actually hits you.
And if you've borrowed on that equity in the house when it was at $400,000, you're up the creek now.
Right. Now, here's the thing. Okay, there's an answer for this, okay, and I'll make it simple. It's methanol. Methanol is the simplest alcohol. It's known as wood alcohol. It's not the kind of alcohol that you drink, but it's easily made. It is one of the top five industrial commodities produced in the world, and it's currently selling without any subsidy for $1.28 a gallon.
How's it made, Robert?
It can be made from coal, it can be made from natural gas, it can be made from any kind of biomass without exception, like forestry.
Right. Unlike ethanol, which comes from like corn or other crops.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, and it can be made from trash, in fact. And as I said, its current price is $1.28 a gallon. Now, it has less energy per gallon than gasoline, so ethanol at $1.28 is about equal to gasoline at $2 a gallon.
Still a deal.
Still a deal, exactly. And any car, any car produced since 2006 or so, has on it the equipment that would allow it to very rapidly be converted to be able to run on methanol. Any flex fuel car can easily be made to run on methanol. And so there's a bill that's been introduced into the House called the Open Fuel Standards Act, and it has bipartisan support. The lead Republican sponsor is John Tsimikas, who is a conservative Republican from Illinois. The lead Democrat sponsor is Elliot Engel, who's a liberal Democrat from New York City. And there's about 15 others from both parties. What the bill basically says is that within a couple of years, the majority of new cars sold in the U.S. would have to be able to run, have to be fully flex fuel, able to run equally well on methanol, ethanol, or gasoline, thus giving the consumer complete fuel choice. Now, if you have fuel choice and methanol is available for $1.28, it means they can't sell gasoline for $4. Okay, keep it competitive. So what this is going to do is crush the price of oil. That's what it's going to do. So even for the people who don't get cars that are capable of running on methanol, the fact that gasoline will be forced into competition with methanol will enormously benefit them. And in fact, it will destroy the oil cartel completely. And this is how we break free of oil. This is how we destroy OPEC. And, in terms of, fuel economy, a car that gets 24 miles to the gallon on methanol is equivalent in fuel economy to a car that gets 60 miles to the gallon on gasoline. And by the way, tomorrow I have an article that's going to be published in National Review Online in which I'm making an open bet to the public. I'm betting $10,000 each to any 10 people who want to bet me that I can take my 2007 Chevy Cobalt and convert it to run on methanol and get at least 24 miles to the gallon, which, as I say, in fuel economy would be almost equal to 60 miles per gallon in with gasoline.
If you're making that bet, I bet you've already tested it.
Well, we'll see. But there's my bet that I'm throwing. If people say they don't think it can be done. Now, President Obama, he's saying he wants to change regulations so that cars will get 54 miles to the gallon on gasoline by the year 2025. I'm betting people I can do it this way by Columbus Day.
Well, you might be able to, Robert.
Yeah.
You might be
so
able to.
So people should take a look at that article, and if you don't think it can be done, I'm willing to take your bet. But it should let you know something, the fact that I am willing to put $100,000 on the line here, that I've got good reason to believe that it can be done. So you should believe that it can be done. And that Congress should get on into action here and make it possible for the American people to get this kind of fuel economy and not have to wait till 2025.
How political is all this?
Well, it's extremely political. There's a lot of money at stake here. Oil cartel wants to be able to continue to loot the U.S. and Europe and Japan. They've got money. There's Saudi money going into every major think tank in Washington practically, so that if they can't buy the politicians, and in some cases they can, but in some cases they can't, they can buy the professors that give them their ideas. And they've managed to hose this thing up. I mean, look, the United States has had a ridiculously incompetent energy policy for the past 35 years. Ever since 1973, we've known this was a problem. And what happened? In 1973, we were 30% dependent on foreign oil. Okay, and they said, we got to do something about this. Well, they did something about it. We're now 65%
dependent on foreign oil. We went the other way.
Yes, and it's so easy. I mean, look, the United States has 4 billion tons of oil reserves. We have 300 billion tons of coal reserves, and coal can be turned into methanol, and it's cheap, and it burns clean, and it's easy to make any car run on it. You don't need to talk about futuristic technology. As I say, I'm betting I can take my 2007 Chevy and make it run on methanol and get superior fuel economy to what President Obama is promising the American people will be accomplished in the year 2025.
Now, technically, what do you have to do with a car, with a new car like you were saying? What do you have to do to switch it over?
Okay, a couple things. You have to, every car, at least every GM and Ford car, and my guess is all the other cars as well, has a computer in it that is capable of flex fuel operation, that is adjusting to compensate for what fuel it's using automatically. That program has to be put in the computer. The Chevy Cobalt uses the same computer as the HHR, which is a flex fuel car.
So you don't have to change fuel injectors, hoses, nothing like that?
Nothing. Now, there's one. Now, if you want to use if you activate that programming, you'll be able to run on either ethanol or gasoline. But some of the car makers, like GM, have, in their infinite wisdom, put a Viton seal in between the fuel pump and the fuel tank, which is not compatible with methanol. That seal needs to be replaced by one made of Buna-N rubber, which is actually cheaper than Viton. And the part costs 41 cents retail. Unfortunately, if you're replacing that on a car that has already been built, the labor will cost you a couple of hundred dollars. Now, to do that, though, to simply pass a law requiring that the automakers install methanol fuel compatible seals in the car when they're being manufactured, which would cost them nothing, and they activate the flex fuel programming in all their cars because that would cost them nothing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe okay. A switch or something?
Yes. Basically, it gives the consumer fuel choice. There is no downside for this. For the consumer. If the consumer wants to run on gasoline, they can. Okay. The problem is that the car makers, have decided to make all but a tiny minority of their cars incompatible with non-petroleum fuels. Now, there's a reason for this. Okay, and the reason for this is that the people who own the car companies have much larger ownership interests in oil. Okay, in some cases, it's really blatant. For instance, Volkswagen, the controlling interest is the government of Qatar, an Arab emirate.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Daimler, the controlling interest is held by the governments of Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. Okay, in Fiat, there's not a controlling interest, but a 2% interest from the government of Libya. Okay, and Fiat owns the majority of Chrysler. Now, in the case of GM and Ford, you have a couple of things. Prince Bin Talal of Saudi Arabia is the fourth largest stockholder in GM. He's a member of the Saudi royal family. When President Obama changed the management of GM, his auto czar, Stephen Ratner, installed as president and later chairman of the board of GM, Ed Whitaker, who's the director of Exxon. Okay, and then they brought in as the new president, Dan Akerson, who was formerly the managing partner of the Carlyle Group, which is a Saudi-backed business partnership in Washington, D.C. Furthermore, the largest stock positions in both Ford and GM are held by a set of Wall Street investment funds, which, while they own a few billion each of GM and Ford, own 10 to 100 times that much in an oil company.
See, their tentacles go everywhere, Robert,
they? That's right. So unless these people are told that they have to make their cars compatible with methanol, they're not going to.
Are there any methanol service stations, fill-up stations?
No, or very few. There might be a couple in California. But And there won't be any until their car's capable of running on it. But you see, that's the beauty of the flex fuel car. The flex fuel car doesn't need to run on methanol. The flex fuel car is simply able to run on methanol just as well as it's able to run on gasoline or ethanol.
Well, you know, they mandated television stations to go to high definition. They gave them a certain amount of time to technologically get their act together to, as they went from channels 2, 4, 7, your regular analog stations to digital, they mandated that. Why can't they do the same thing with cars?
Well, that's what they need to do. Okay, it doesn't happen by itself. Now, if they simply mandated that the auto companies stop limiting the choice of their consumers to the petroleum fuel, because basically what this is a conspiracy and restraint of trade.
Well, and couldn't a gas station that may have 10 pumps allocate a couple pumps to methanol without, having to shut down their place or reconstruct it?
Right, but they won't do that until they see there's a lot of cars out there that can use it. So that's the point of the Open Fuel Standard Bill. That is, once this is passed, within 3 years, you'll have 30 million cars in the United States capable of running on alternate fuels. And at that point, you'll start seeing methanol pumps appear at every 7-Eleven.
Absolutely. Then you'll have a market. But it's got to go in tandem, though, Robert. You can't build one first without the other one.
Well, no, you can build flex fuel cars first because they can run fine on gasoline. But once they reach a critical mass, then people will start installing pumps. You can't sell books to a population that can't read.
That's true. Hold on, Robert. We'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're going to take your calls next hour with Robert Zubrin as we talk about energy victory and the case for Mars as well. And when I come back in just a moment, we'll talk more about his thoughts about methanol as a fuel source on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Robert Zubrin. Robert, we saw the tragedy when the tsunami hit the Japanese nuclear power plant and what happened there. Does nuclear power fit into your plan?
Well, I'm pro-nuclear. it is remarkable in an earthquake and tsunami situation that killed 28,000 people from tidal waves and falling buildings and fire and exposure and all these other things. Not a single person was killed from radiation released from the power plant. But 28,000 people have been killed from everything else so far. And in fact, that's all I need to say about that. But to get to answer your question is, I think we should continue to build nuclear power plants, but they don't address the critical need that we have, which is not electricity, which is what nuclear power plants make. It's liquid fuels. Okay, that's where we're over a barrel. We're over a barrel because right now, while there's any number of ways to make electricity, there's nuclear, there's hydroelectric, there's oil, there's coal, there's natural gas. Right now, from a practical point of view, the only way to make anything move on the surface of the earth pretty much is oil. Okay? Cars, trucks, airplanes, even things like ships and trains that used to move with coal now all move with oil. And that makes oil the number one strategic commodity in the world. And unfortunately, 80% of the world's oil reserves are held by a group of 13 tyrannies known as OPEC, led by Saudi Arabia. And they have had a policy of restricting the production of oil in order to drive the price through the roof and are therefore looting us. It's like you live in a town where there's only one water supply, and the guy who controls it is limiting the amount that he's taking from the well, and he's charging you $1,000 a cup. And pretty soon he's going to take your house because you're going to have to mortgage it in order to be able to drink water. So you have to, if you want to keep your house, if you want to keep your livelihood, you have to do something about that. You can't just stay dependent upon this bandit who is choking you by restricting the supply of this vital fluid. And that's the situation we're in with oil. Now, it's really crazy. This country has, you know, hundreds of times as much coal as it has oil, and hundreds of times as much natural gas as it has oil. And both coal and natural gas can easily be turned into methanol, and it's cheaper than gasoline in terms of miles per dollar. All we have to do is make our cars compatible with that, and we'll be able to use the resources that we have. Now, you think about this. $500 billion this year we're paying for foreign oil. That's $500 billion taken right out of our GNP. Now, it takes $100,000 of GNP to create one job. That is, we have a $15 trillion GNP. We have 150 million people working in this country. You divide 150 million into 15 trillion, works out to $100,000 a job. So at $100,000 a job, $500 billion works out to 5 million jobs. If we were to make that fuel here in the United States instead of buying it from abroad, we're talking about putting 5 million people to work in this country. That would reduce our unemployment rate in this country by a third, right there. And that would take 500 million people off the unemployment rolls and put them on the tax rolls. And that's how you stop us from going bankrupt, which is what's happening to this country right now. And because we're going bankrupt, you know, we're going to have to be cutting down our military. So our world military strength is going down. You know, money decides everything here. And if we continue to pay out our treasure for this foreign oil instead of using the fuel that we can make here, we're going to go broke. Okay, we're going to continue to have more and more people unemployed. We won't have enough tax revenues. We won't be able to sustain the military. We won't be able to pay the Social Security. The retirees are going to be thrown out on the street. You know, everything bad that people talk about, it's all going to happen if we continue to let ourselves be looted into poverty.
What happened to our reliance on coal and the abundance of coal that we have, Robert? I mean, was it an environmental issue that got us to stop using it generally?
Well, no, we haven't stopped using it.
Well, no, but generally. I mean, it's not like we used to.
Well, it's almost, we still get 40% of our electricity from coal. Coal, we get more electricity from coal than any other single thing. We have never gotten a significant fraction of our vehicle fuel from coal because, you see, in the past, oil was cheap, okay? Until 1973, oil was $3 a barrel. And even in 1999, oil was $11 a barrel. Okay? But now it's $100 a barrel. Now, what else can you think of? Its price has gone up more than 10 times since 1999.
Yeah.
Okay, that's because it's being rigged. It's being rigged at our expense. And you see, and you have to understand this. This is not like the weather or something. This is being done to us. There is an enemy here. The blows that we're feeling on top of our head are not ourselves crashing into the furniture. It is someone hitting us on the head with a baseball bat. And we have to fight back. And the way to fight back is to make ourselves able to use the fuel resources that we have. And while we can drill more than we are, the fact of the matter is this. Currently, the United States uses 25% of the world's liquid fuel. We make 8% of the world's liquid fuel. We have to triple our fuel production if we're to become independent in liquid fuel. And we can't do that with a little more drilling, and we can't do that with a little more corn ethanol. We've got to be able to tap into our coal and natural gas and broad biomass reserves. The one fuel that can do that is methanol. It's the universal solvent here. Anything that is or was once a plant can be turned into methanol. And we're not talking about some futuristic thing like cellulosic ethanol or something made from algae or mushrooms or whatever. We're talking about something that is already one of the top five chemical commodities produced in the world, 30 billion gallons a year. We already know how to mass produce it. We just need to make our cars compatible with it.
Tell me your story of how we won World War II based on oil. It's fascinating.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Today we produce 8% of the world's oil. In 1940s, we produced 60% of the world's oil. Okay, and the Soviet Union, which was our ally at that point, produced 15%. The British controlled another 10% in the Middle East, and we controlled another 10% in Latin America. That's 95%. The Axis powers only had control of 5% of the world's oil, which were the Indonesian oil fields that the Japanese managed to seize in their successes following Pearl Harbor. And then there was the Romanian oil fields, because Romania was a Nazi ally in Plessy. And then there were the Germans' own synthetic fuel plants at Leona in central Germany. Now, this shortage of oil greatly conditioned the whole Axis war strategy. This is why the Germans made their drive for the Caucasus, to try to seize the Russian oil. But when the Germans lost the Battle of Stalingrad and the Russians started advancing towards the Black Sea from Stalingrad and threatening to cut off the German armies in the Caucasus, they had to pull out. And they were thrown back, limited to the three supplies that I just mentioned. And then when the American Army Air Corps destroyed Plessy and destroyed the synthetic fuel plants in Leona in central Germany in 1944, May 12, 1944, that's the day the war was won. That's the day that the American Army Air Corps hit Leona with 935 B-24s and totally destroyed it in a single day. And, you know, Albert Speer, who was the German Minister of Armaments and Industry, he got out of prison in the 60s, and he wrote his book, Inside the Third Reich. And he writes in the book, I'll never forget that day, May 12, 1944. On that day, the war was lost. On that day, they finally hit our weak spot. And that was it. Within 3 months, the Germans were practically out of gas. They couldn't move their tanks. They couldn't fly their planes. Their last panzer offensive in the Ardennes in 1944 literally ran out of gas right on the battlefield.
Could that happen again?
Well, this time it could happen to us.
Yeah.
Okay, because this time, instead of, being the ones who had plenty of oil who could cut off the enemy's oil, now we only produce 8% of the world's liquid fuel. If there was another war like that, we would lose because enemy submarines would cut us off from our oil imports and they would collapse the U.S. economy and with it the war effort. So this is a huge national security issue as well as an economic issue, and we need to remedy it. And it's the first responsibility of government is national defense. They have to take action on this. Okay, and it's national defense, not only against, some war that might happen someday. It's national defense against us being robbed today.
If we didn't have the military might that we have right now, we would be chokehold, wouldn't we?
Well, we'd be even more vulnerable than we are. But frankly, you don't need overwhelming military force to cut off someone's oil supplies. You need overwhelming military force to protect your oil supplies. It's much easier to cut them off than it is to protect them.
I see. I think we would go into these countries if they cut us off, don't you?
Well, you understand. I mean, even if you went into them, even if you see Saudi Arabia, you still have to move the oil from Saudi Arabia to here. I mean, you know, in World War II, the Japanese seized Indonesia, and we never took it back during the war. But we sank the Japanese tanker fleet, and they couldn't get the oil to Japan.
Which brings up, of course, the situation that we had in the Gulf. What's happening there with drilling in the Gulf?
Well, there is more or less been a suspension of that. And that is going to make the, if we stick with being dependent on oil, that will make us even more dependent on foreign oil than we already are.
True. Is there a way out of this? Really?
This is the way. The way, it's really simple. Okay? All we have to do is make sure our cars are able to use the fuels that we have in abundance, which is basically methanol. And it's a very minor change.
And what about diesel trucks? Would you switch them over or would they stay on diesel?
Well, they can stay on diesel because that's fine. We don't have to switch every car over. There's certain reasons why you want to run trucks on diesel. But the fact of the matter is, if we can switch these gasoline cars to being flex fuel, they will drive down the price of oil such that even the vehicles that still have to use oil, like those diesel trucks, they're going to get a much better deal because the price of oil will be driven below $50 a barrel.
Even if we had 25% of our cars doing methanol, we'd save a fortune, wouldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. You see, that's the thing. It's like this. If there's only one big department store in the town, they can charge people whatever they want for their goods. Okay. Now, one little store comes into town to compete with them, and they have to drop their price radically. And even if they still keep 90% of the business themselves, the prices are going to be much lower because they have to keep them low if they're going to maintain their market dominance. And so that's the point. If you simply even take a substantial minority of the cars and make them flex fuel so that you have active competition, so that gasoline has to compete against the price of cheap methanol, it will force down the price of gasoline. And so those people who want to continue to use gasoline, they will benefit greatly because the gasoline will be cheaper. And those people who want to use the methanol, they will have the opportunity to do that. They'll have choice.
Let me get your take on global warming. I've had a number of people who do not believe that it's man-made global warming. We've had a few that have said, yes, it is. Overwhelmingly, I think it's beginning to change. What do you think?
Well, I think, look, the first issue is this, is should it be state policy to try to control the weather? And in particular, should it be state policy to try to control the weather by limiting the right of people to use fire? Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's outrageous.
We don't burn leaves anymore, do we?
Yeah, but we don't burn leaves, but that's fine. But what I'm saying, by use fire, I mean any form of combustion, including fossil fuels and so forth. The fire is what lifted us above the animal kingdom. I mean, fire is the basis of civilization. If you limit the right of people to use fire or to use combustion by taxing fuels, which is basically what the cap and trade policy is, first of all, it's an extremely regressive tax. It's a tax that hurts the poor much more than the rich. And I mean, you know, some stockbroker on Park Avenue, making $30 million a year doesn't use any more electricity than a poor family in Harlem making $30,000 a year. Okay. So if the price of electricity goes up by $300 a month, he doesn't even notice it. On the other hand, it's a killing burden for them.
Well, unless his house is using up so much.
Yeah. But The point is this.
I don't think the $300 million stockbroker is going to live in the kind of house some poor person in Harlem would.
Well, he might live in a penthouse instead of a cockroach-ridden apartment, but he's not. He might use twice as much electricity as them, but he's not going to use 100 times as much electricity as them. It just is not possible. You know, just like pay taxes on basic things like electricity and food hurt the poor the most. So what we're talking about here is a program of regressive taxation. And it's a job killer because it attacks industry. It attacks people who make their money by doing anything real, making real products, you know, instead of buying and selling stocks and things, okay? So it's exactly the wrong thing to do. It's a program for oppressing the poor, for crimping the economy. You know, it's like back in 1972, the Club of Rome came out with this book called The Limits to Growth, and they said the consumption of the world, and especially the poor, has to be limited because we're running out of resources. Well, it turned out to be completely false that we're running out of resources. So now instead they're saying we're running out of the right to use resources. We will pretend that we're running out of resources. We will tax not resources but the right to use them, and that's basically what carbon credits are. So that's my answer. You know, global warming, it might be happening, and there's absolutely a 50% chance that next year will be warmer than this year because the climate is always changing. And it is even possible that human CO2 emissions have something to do with it. But would global warming be a catastrophe? There's no evidence for that. In fact, there's no evidence that it's even bad. The main effect of global warming is to lengthen the growing season.
And we're probably in an Earth cycle anyways, Robert.
Well, we may very well be. But even if we stipulate that there is human-driven global warming, you have to ask yourself the question, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, a couple of things about that. Global warming lengthens the growing season, and CO2 enrichment of the atmosphere accelerates plant growth.
Yes,
and
it does.
And that's a fact, by the way. We have photographs taken from space since 1958, and during which time the world's CO2 in the atmosphere has increased by 19%. And according to our satellites, the rate of growth of plants on Earth has accelerated by 15% since 1958. I'm not talking about farm plants. Those have done much better than that because that's agricultural technology.
Sure.
I'm talking about wild plants, forests, because when you enrich the CO2 content to the atmosphere, that's more food for plants to grow with.
Well, and we know what this planet was like back 60 million years ago with a higher carbon dioxide in the atmosphere level.
Right. Then it was 7 times as high as it is now. Okay, but yes, so certainly there's no particular evidence that having such a low CO2 amount in the atmosphere as we do today is actually good. There's a lot of evidence to suggest it'd be better for the biosphere if it was enriched somewhat. So I don't think that adding CO2 in the atmosphere in the moderate amounts that we're currently doing is a bad thing. It looks like it's a good thing, and in any case, if it was a bad thing, I would not approve of regressive social policies as a way to deal with it. And frankly, the same people who are advocating these policies now because they say they're afraid of global warming in the 1970s were advocating the exact same policies because they said they were afraid of global cooling.
Robert, when we come back, we're going to take some phone calls with you here on Coast to Coast AM and Robert's website, MarsSociety.org. And energyvictory.net. We'll be right back.